You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We're going to start our show on gaps with a singular concept that affects everyone: global inequality. Right now, the richest 1% of people around the world own almost half of global wealth. That's according to the bank Credit Suisse. And that gap between rich and poor around the world filters down to individual countries, populations, and people. We're going to hear about inequality in one of the fastest growing countries in the world, China, in a few moments. But first, we wanted to talk to one of the top scholars of inequality today. That's Branko Milanović, and he teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He measures inequality around the world, and I asked him to take this broad picture of inequality and explain its consequences to us.
Now, the consequences are trickier because you don't have a world government. If you study U.S. income inequality, implicitly what you find sort of speaks to the U.S. political spectrum, to the U.S. media. But when you don't have these institutions globally, there is no addressee to whom you are actually telling certain things. It's only indirectly, like speaking on shows or giving talks, that you actually make people sort of realize and maybe potentially even act upon these gaps.
So you invented a way of measuring inequality, measuring gaps. What do you measure?
Well, you measure essentially differences in income between all individuals in the world. We have anonymous random surveys that you collect, which collect information about incomes, you know, spending patterns, age, education, and so on. And then you essentially have to put them all together to adjust for price levels, because India obviously has lower price levels than the U.S. And then you have the world or global income distribution. That's something that you could not do that like 15 or 20 years ago.
There seems to be a very important difference between an income gap and a wealth gap. What's the difference and why is that so important?
Well, Lizzie, it's actually an excellent question because people very often think of the two the same, but you know they are not. Income is actually what you're earning, for example, this month or this year. So even if you're very, very poor, if you're really among poorest people in Africa, you would still have something because you would be basically working. But wealth is very different. Wealth is a result of your accumulation and saving and investment over a life cycle or what you have inherited from the past. So the gaps in wealth are much, much greater than the gaps in income. In other words, for wealth, you have actually billions of people and even like about 30% of people in the United States who have zero net wealth. And you don't have people who have zero income.
All of this brings up the very basic question of why? What are the roots of this?
Well, the roots, of course, are manifold. It's not simple. But if you actually just focus on individual countries, let's say, like you look at the U.S. alone, you have historical roots, as we know, you know, differences in education levels, opportunity to actually exercise your own potential, which existed very strongly between, obviously, African Americans and the others, white Americans. And then you have gaps, which are gender gaps, which still exist. It's very hard when you actually start behind the others to catch up. And if the system does not sufficiently correct for that unevenness, then really that gets magnified. And I think it's not an easy thing to adjust for.
When we heard from one of the people we talked to in China, she referenced education and other social structures as a way to move ahead or a way to kind of keep you stuck where you are. What are the social factors that play into this?
You know, education certainly has historically, at least the last probably century or two, has been a way for people who actually start with relatively low incomes to make themselves much better off and consequently their own children and grandchildren and so on.
Is there a difference between how much these gaps matter in, say, a developed country versus an emerging country like India or Brazil?
I have a nice story maybe that, you know, you might like.
Yeah.
Is that if you take, for example, European countries and take UK, which is pretty unequal in Europe, and let's suppose UK becomes the 51st US state, it would be a fairly moderately unequal state within the United States.
Wow.
But then you take all the U.S. states, and let's suppose U.S. and Latin America become like one country, as it were, then you would suddenly realize something else, that all U.S. states, each individually and U.S. combined, are more equal than any country in Latin America. So that would be kind of a comparison which you can make.
One of the biggest debates that has gone on in the past few years, and I know you've taken part in this, is does inequality harm growth? Because you look at some place like China or India where there's tremendous inequality and their economies have gone gangbusters.
Well, it's true. You know, there was, of course, historically, there was an argument which has some validity that you need inequality in order to actually have rich people, and rich people are going to save. And as they save, of course, they would invest, create new jobs, and then you have increased employment and the economy grows faster. But there is, of course, the alternative view, and we have seen some evidence, and we have also have some empirical results that show if you have an inequality which is beyond a certain point, it might have detrimental effects.
All of this raises the question of what should you do to correct inequality, or should you do anything?
At the level of individual countries, I think one big way to try to redress inequality is education. Now, there are, of course, other things like policies, like we have seen arguments for increased taxation, particularly on very high incomes, then to increase taxation on wealth, and then, for example, to increase minimum wage. So these are all policies that you can do at the level either the state or country. But then when you come to the world, obviously you cannot do that because there is no world government. But there you can actually use other things, which is migration, which I think is an important means towards reduction of global poverty and global inequality.
So you think that we should, we being the larger world, we step in and do something about these gaps?
Well, I think so. I think so that we, being like everybody that we can sort of think of, should be concerned, and we are concerned, with gaps within nations. When it comes to the world, you really have to rely mostly on continued high growth rates in China and India, which are really crucial for the world inequality to go down. And then the other way that, of course, rich countries can help is by making migration easier. You know, I actually have a map of the world with 8 points in the world where the gaps are physically between the two countries that are contiguous are really enormous. And what you find out is that you have fences being built everywhere. You actually have lots of poor people who are left behind. You don't use their skills. It's like having discrimination, for example, of women. You have half of the population in some countries that actually are not used. And likewise, if you have high inequality, you have lots of people who are left out.
Branko Milanović is a professor at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Lizzie. It was really a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We just heard about wealth and income gaps around the world, and we wanted to give you a little snapshot of what that feels like. So we decided to go to China. Well, okay, not go to China, but talk to some people there, because China is both an engine of growth and a place where the gap between the rich and poor is one of the world's biggest. We reached out to Luke Sanford and Rylene Lee, two people living in Chengdu, China, and experiencing very different economies.
So when I first came to China, which was like 3 years ago, my salary was about $1,000 a month, which for people who lived in the city that I lived in, which was a smaller town of about 30,000 people, is like a really good salary. When I moved into a big city, which is Chengdu, that salary is barely enough to pay rent and eat on a daily basis. And so here, I make like pennies compared to the people that I see around me every day.
That feeling of discrepancy is not uncommon, either for foreigners living in China or for Chinese citizens.
I don't have any connections or any kind of rich mom or rich dad. So normally I find a job by myself, and I think I earn very little money.
Rylin Lee says the roots of that wealth gap are deeply entrenched.
Most of the rich people will send their kids to go to America or maybe some other countries to pursue the education. It's kind of more like complicated to find a job with a good payment if you don't have a good education. For myself, because I got an education from abroad, I got my job very easily. Some places in China still now, they don't have a good education system, and lots of like countryside still cannot even go to school. But in the city, people will be care about the life standards of the children and kids in cities. They'll have their personal tutors. So yeah, very, very big gap though.
And that gap between people who are making a lot of money and the majority of people who aren't, it's becoming more visible.
People are definitely noticing more and more this big wealth gap. Just today walking over here, I saw somebody driving a Bentley, which is something that is just totally unfathomable to like 95% of the population. About one block away from where I am right now, there's like a luxury products mall. And then less than a block away from there, there's an area where you can buy food that's full of migrant workers. The juxtaposition is becoming more and more apparent.